My name is Michael McCusker, and Happy New Year. If any one of you noticed, I have been gone the last couple of weeks. I was robotically archived the past two Thursdays, old shows. And I guess if I'd known that Haditha had been dredged up again, I would have brought a story I'd written about Haditha and the Marine Corps' involvement in that. Because today is the day that I turned myself over to Marine Corps boot camp 52 years ago. It's a life-changing sort of experience, and anyone who's ever been through a basic training in any of the services anywhere in the world would know exactly how much that is, especially if later on you wound up in a war, as I did. But everything was different after my DIs got a hold of me. Well, this morning I'd like to read a couple of articles that I pulled off the computer while I was at my sister's house these past couple of weeks in Walport. And they're all more or less around the Occupy Wall Street movement, or simply the Occupy movement. I'll start out with one from the New York Times. What If We Occupied Language? By H. Sami, or Sami Alin, who directs the Center for Race, Ethnicity, and Language at Stanford University. And he has a forthcoming book, Articulate While Black, Barack Obama, Language and Race in the United States, written with Geneva Smitherman. And it examines the racial politics of the Obama presidency through a linguistic lens. What If We Occupied Language? By H. Sami Alin. When I flew out from the San Francisco airport last October, we crossed above the ports that Occupy Oakland helped shut down and arrived in Germany to be met by traffic caused by Occupy Berlin protesters. But the movement has not only transformed public space, it has transformed the public discourse as well. Occupy. It is now nearly impossible to hear the word and not think of the Occupy movement. Even as distinguished an expert as the lexicographer and columnist Ben Zimmer admitted as much last week, Occupy, he said, is the odds-on favorite to be chosen as the American Dialect Society's word of the year. It has already succeeded in shifting the terms of the debate, taking phrases like debt ceiling and budget crisis out of the limelight, and putting terms like inequality and greed squarely in the center. This discursive shift has made it more difficult for Washington to continue to promote the spurious reasons for this financial meltdown and the unequal outcomes it has exposed and further produced. To most, the irony of a progressive social movement using the term Occupy to reshape how Americans think about issues of democracy and equality has been clear. After all, it is generally nations, armies, and police who occupy, usually by force. And in this, the United States has been a leader. The American government is just now, after 9 years, ending its overt occupation of Iraq, is still entrenched in Afghanistan, and is maintaining troops on the ground in dozens of countries worldwide. All this is not to obscure the fact that the United States as we know it came into being by way of an occupation, a gradual and devastatingly violent one that all but extinguished entire Native American populations across thousands of miles of land. Yet, in a very short time, this movement has dramatically changed how we think about occupation. In early September, Occupy signaled ongoing military incursions. Now it signifies progressive political protest. It is no longer primarily about force of military power. Instead, it signifies standing up to injustice, inequality, and abuse of power. It is no longer about simply occupying a space. It is about transforming that space. In this sense, Occupy Wall Street as occupied language has made Occupy its own. And importantly, people from diverse ethnicities, cultures, and languages have participated in this linguistic occupation. It is distinct from the history of forcible occupation in that it is built to accommodate all, not just the most powerful or violent. As Joff Nunberg, the longtime chair of the usage panel for American Heritage Dictionary, and who often appears on Fresh Air, and others have explained, the earliest use of occupy in English that was linked to protests can be traced to English media descriptions of Italian demonstrations in the 1920s, in which workers occupied, and that's a quote, factories until their demands were met. This is a far cry from some of its earlier meanings. In fact, the Oxford English Dictionary tells us that occupy once meant, quote, to have sexual intercourse with, unquote. One could imagine what a phrase like Occupy Wall Street might have meant back then. In October, Zimmer, who is also the chair of the American Dialect Society's new Word Committee, noted on NPR's On the Media that the meaning of occupy has changed dramatically since its arrival into the English language in the 14th century. It's almost always been used as a transitive verb, Zimmer said. That's a verb that takes an object, so you occupy a place or a space. But then it became used as a rallying cry, without an object, just to mean to take part in what are now called the Occupy protests. It is being used as a modifier, Occupy protest, Occupy movement. So it's this very flexible word that is now filling many grammatical slots in the language. What if we transformed the meaning of occupy yet again? Specifically, what if we thought of occupy language as more than the language of the occupy movement and began to think about it as a movement in and of itself? What kind of issues would occupy language address? What would taking language back from its self-appointed masters look like? We might start by looking at those questions from the perspective of race and discrimination and answer with how to foster fairness and equality in that realm. Occupy language might draw inspiration from both the way that the Occupy movement has reshaped definitions of occupy, which teaches us that we give words and meaning and that discourses are not immutable, and from the way indigenous movements have contested its use, which teaches us to be ever mindful about how language both empowers and oppresses, unifies and isolates. For starters, occupy language might first look inward. In a recent interview, Julian Padilla of the People of Color Working Group pushed the occupy movement to examine its linguistic choices. To occupy means to hold space, and I think a group of anti-capitalists holding space on Wall Street is powerful. But I do wish the NYC, the New York City, movement would change its name to Decolonize Wall Street, to take into account history, indigenous critiques, people of color, and imperialism. Occupying space is not inherently bad. It's all about who and how and why. When white colonizers occupy land, they don't just sleep there overnight, they steal and destroy. When indigenous people occupied Alcatraz Island, it was an act of protest. And that was Julian Padilla. This linguistic change can remind Americans that a majority of the 99% has benefited from the occupation of native territories. Occupy language might also support the campaign to stop the media from using the word illegal to refer to undocumented immigrants. From the campaign's perspective, only inanimate objects and actions are labeled illegal in English. Therefore, the use of illegals to refer to human beings is dehumanizing. The New York Times style book currently asks writers to avoid terms like illegal alien and undocumented, but says nothing about illegals. Yet the Times Standard editor, Philip B. Corbett, did recently weigh in on this, saying that the term illegals has a, quote, unnecessarily pejorative tone, and that it is wise to steer clear. Pejorative, discriminatory language can have real life consequences. In this case, activists worry about the coincidence of the rise in the use of the term illegals and the spike in hate crimes against all Latinos. As difficult as it might be to prove causation here, the National Institute for Latino Policy reports that the FBI's annual hate crime statistics show that Latinos comprised 2/3 of the victims of ethnically motivated hate crimes in the year 2010. When someone is repeatedly described as something, language has quietly paved the way for violent action. But Occupy language should concern itself with more than just the words we use. It should also work towards eliminating language-based racism and discrimination. In the legal system, CNN recently reported that the U.S. Justice Department alleges that Arizona's infamous Sheriff Joe Arpaio, among other offenses, has discriminated against Latino inmates with limited English by punishing them and denying critical services. In education, as linguistic anthropologist Anna Celia Zantella notes, hostility towards those who speak English with an accent, Asians, Latinos, and African Americans, continues to be a problem. In housing, the National Fair Housing Alliance has long recognized accents as playing a significant role in housing discrimination. On the job market, language-based discrimination intersects with issues of race, ethnicity, class, and national origin to make it more difficult for well-qualified applicants with an accent to receive equal opportunities. In the face of such widespread language-based discrimination, Occupy Language can be a critical, progressive linguistic movement that exposes how language is used as a means of social, political, and economic control. By occupying language, we can expose how educational, political, and social institutions use language to further marginalize oppressed groups, resist colonizing language practices that elevate certain languages over others, resist attempts to define people with terms rooted in negative stereotypes, and begin to reshape the public discourse about our communities and about the central role of language in racism and discrimination. As the global Occupy movement has shown, words can move entire nations of people, even the world, to action. Occupy language as a movement should speak to the power of language to transform how we think about the past, how we act in the present, and how we envision the future. And that was an article, What If We Occupied Language, by H. Sami Alim. And he is, as earlier said, director of the Center for Race, Ethnicity, and Language at Stanford University. Pardon the little bit of a cough. I'd like to continue on with a Tomgram. This is from Tom Engelhart, and he posted it on December 18th. Of last year. It's called The Four Occupations of Planet Earth, How the Occupied Became the Occupiers. On the streets of Moscow and the tens of thousands, the protesters chanted, "We exist." Taking into account the comments of statesmen, scientists, politicians, military officials, bankers, artists, all the important and attended to figures on this planet, nothing caught the ear more strikingly than those two words shouted by massed Russian demonstrators. We exist. Think of it as a simple statement of fact, an implicit demand to be taken seriously or else, and undoubtedly an expression of wonder verging on a question. We exist? And who could be blamed? Who could blame them for shouting it or for the wonder? How miraculous it was. Yet another country, long immersed in a kind of popular silence, suddenly finds voice, and the demonstrators promptly declare themselves not about to leave the stage when the day and the demonstration ends. Who guessed beforehand that perhaps 50,000 Muscovites would turn out to protest a rigged electoral process in a suddenly restive country, along with crowds in St. Petersburg, Tomsk, and elsewhere from the south to Siberia? In Tahrir Square in Cairo, they swore, "This time we're here to stay." Everywhere this past year, it seemed that they, we're here to stay. In New York City, when forced out of Zuccotti Park by the police, Occupy protesters returned carrying signs that said, "You cannot evict an idea whose time has come." And so it seems, globally speaking, Tunis, Cairo, Madrid, Madison, New York, Santiago, Homs, so many cities, towns, places, London, Sana'a, Athens, Oakland, Berlin, Rabat, Boston, Vancouver, Astoria. It could take your breath away. And as for the places that aren't yet bubbling, Japan, China, and elsewhere, watch out in 2012 because, let's face it, we exist. Everywhere, the we couldn't be broader, often remarkably, even strategically, ill-defined, 99% of humanity containing so many potentially conflicting strains of thought and being. Liberals and fundamentalists, left-wing radicals and right-wing nationalists, the middle class and the dismally poor, pensioners and high school students. But the we couldn't be more real. This we is something that hasn't been seen on this planet for a long time, and perhaps never quite so globally. And here's what should take your breath away, and that of the other 1% also. We were never supposed to exist. Everyone, even we, counted us out. Until last December, 2010, when a young Tunisian vegetable vendor set himself alight to protest his own humiliation, that we seemed to consist of the non-actors of the 21st century and much of the previous one as well. We're talking about all those shunted aside, whose lives only weeks, months, or at most a year ago simply didn't matter. All those the powerful absolutely knew they could ride roughshod over as they solidified their control of the planet's wealth, resources, property, as, in fact, they drove this planet down. For them, we was just a mass of subprime humanity that hardly existed. So of all the statements of 2011, the simplest of them, we exist, has been by far the most powerful. Name of the year, Occupy Wall Street. Every year since 1927, when it chose Charles Lindbergh for his famed flight across the Atlantic, Time magazine has picked a man, even when on rare occasions it was a woman like Queen Elizabeth II, or after 1999, a person of the year, though sometimes it's been an inanimate object like the computer, or a group or an idea. If you want a gauge of how we have changed the global conversation in just months, those in the running this year included Arab youth protesters, Anonymous, the 99%, and the 1%. Admittedly, so were Kim Kardashian, Casey Anthony, Michelle Bachmann, Kay Middleton, and Rupert Murdoch. In the end, the magazine's winner of 2011 was the protester. How could it have been otherwise? We exist, and even time knows it. From Tunis in January to Moscow in December, this has been day by day, week by week, month by month, the year of the protester. Those looking back may see clues to what was to come in isolated eruptions, like the suppressed Green Movement in Iran or under-the-radar civic activism emerging in Russia. Nonetheless, protest, when it arrived, seemed to come out of the blue. Unpredicted and unprepared for, the young, followed by the middle-aged and the old, took to the streets of cities around the globe and simply refused to go home, even when the police arrived, even when the thugs arrived, even when the army arrived, even when the pepper spraying, the arrests, the wounds, the deaths began and didn't stop. And by the way, if we exist is the signature statement of 2011. The name of the year would have to be Occupy Wall Street. Forget the fact that the place occupied Zuccotti Park wasn't on Wall Street but two blocks away, and that compared to Tahrir Square or Moscow's thoroughfares, it was one of the smallest plots of protest land on the planet. It didn't matter. The phrase was blowback of the first order. It was payback, too. Those three words instantly turned history of the last two decades upside down and helped establish the protesters of 2011 as the third of the four great planetary occupations of our era. Previously, occupations had been relatively local affairs. You occupied a country, the occupation of Japan, usually a defeated or conquered one. but on our own time, if it were left to me, I'd tell the history of humanity, American style, as the story of four occupations, each global in nature. The first occupation. In the 1990s, the financial types of our world set out to occupy the wealth, planetarily speaking. These were, of course, the globalists, now better known as the neoliberals, and they were determined to open markets everywhere. They were out, as Thomas Friedman put it, though he hardly meant it quite this way, to flatten the earth, which turned out to be a violent proposition. The neoliberals were let loose to do their damnedest in the good times of the post-Cold War Clinton years. They wanted to apply a kind of American economic clout that they thought would never end to the organization of the planet. They believed the U.S. to be the economic superpower of the ages, and they had their own dreamy version of what an economic Americana would be like. Privatization was the name of the game, and their version of shock and awe tactics involved calling in institutions like the International Monetary Fund to discipline, and that's a quote, developing countries into a profitable kind of poverty and misery. In the end, gleefully slicing and dicing subprime mortgages, they financialized the world and so drove a hole through it. They were our economic jihadis, and in the great meltdown of 2008, they deep-sixed the world economy they had helped unify, and that's a quote. In the process, by increasing the gap between the super-rich and everyone else, they helped create the 1% and the 99% in the United States and globally, preparing the ground for the protests to follow. The second occupation. If the first occupation drove an economic stake through the heart of the planet, the second did a similar thing militarily. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, the unilateralists of the Bush administration staked their own claim to a global occupation at the point of a cruise missile. Romantics all, when it came to the U.S. military and what it could do, they invaded Iraq, determined to garrison the oil heartlands of the planet. It was going to be shock and awe and a mission accomplished all the way. And what they had in mind was a militarized version of an Occupy the Wealth scheme. Their urge to privatize even extended to the military itself, and when they invaded, in their baggage train came crony corporations ready to feast. Once upon a time, Americans knew that only the monstrous enemy, most recently the evil empire, the Soviet Union, could dream of world conquest and occupation. That was, by nature, what evil monsters did. Until 2001, when it turned out to be quite okay for the good guys of the planet to think along exactly the same lines. The third occupation. The most significant and most surprising thing the first two globalizing occupations did, however, was to globalize protest. Together, they created the basis in pure iniquity and inequity, in dead bodies and bruised lives, for Tahrir Square and Occupy Wall Street. Their failure set the stage for something new in the world. The result was a Chalmers-Johnson-style case of blowback, the spirit of which was caught in the protesters' appropriation of the very word occupy. There was a sense out there that they had occupied us long and disastrously enough. It was time for us to occupy them. And so our own parks, squares, streets, towns, cities, and countries. The urge to right things is, in fact, a powerful one. Gene Turritz, a friend of mine who took part in the demonstrations that briefly shut down the port of Oakland, California, recently wrote me the following about the experience. It catches something of the mood of this moment. Quote, "The mayor of Oakland, a former progressive, blasted the economic violence that was being perpetrated by the Occupy movement, shutting down the port. No word about the economic violence of banks stealing people's homes through foreclosures, or the economic violence of sports team owners demanding the city build new stadiums for their teams, or they will move to another city, or if corporations threatening to move if this or that was not done for them. That's just the way things are done. You do not want the violence of thousands of people peacefully showing that things must change to make their lives better. Or, in two words, we exist, and possibly in the nick of time." The fourth occupation. This is both the newest and oldest of occupations. I'm speaking about humanity's occupation of Earth. In recent centuries, can there be any question that we've been hard on this planet, exploiting it for everything it's worth? Our excuse was that we genuinely didn't know better, at least when it came to climate change, that we just didn't understand what kind of long-term harm the burning of fossil fuels could do. Now, of course, we know. Those who don't are either in denial or simply couldn't care less. And here's just a taste of what we do know about how the fourth occupation is affecting the planet. 13 of the warmest years since record-keeping began have occurred in the last 15 years. In 2010, historically staggering amounts of carbon dioxide were sent into the atmosphere, the biggest jump ever seen in global warming gases. Extreme weather was, well, remarkably extreme in 2011. Torrid droughts, massive fires, vast floods, and in the Arctic, ice is now melting at unprecedented rates, which will mean future sea level rises that will threaten low-lying areas of the planet. And as for that temperature, well, it's going to keep going up, uncomfortably so. Potentially, this is the monster blowback story of all time. And here's just a taste of what we know about the business as usual on this planet. If we rely on the previous occupiers and their ilk to save us, then it's going to be a long, dismal wait. Don't count on energy giants like Exxon or BP or their lobbyists and the politicians they influence to stop climate change. After all, none of them are going to be alive to see a far less habitable planet. So what do they care? Torrid zones are so then. Profit sheets and bonuses are so now, which means don't count on the 1% to give a damn. If it were up to them, a few outliers among them accepted, we could probably simply write the Earth off as a future-friendly place for us, and the planet wouldn't care. Give it 100,000, 10 million, 100 million years, and it'll get itself back in shape with plenty of life forms to go around. We're such ephemeral creatures with such brief lifespans, it's hard for us to think even in the sort of modestly long-range way that climate change demands. So thank your lucky stars that the first and second wave occupiers created a third payback occupation they never imagined possible. And thank your lucky stars that movements to occupy our planet in a new way and turn back the global warmers are slowly rising as well. Like the attempted occupations of the global economy and the greater Middle East, each spurred by a sense of greed that went beyond all bounds, the occupation of our planet is guaranteed to create its own oppositional forces, and not just in the natural world either. They are perhaps already emerging along with the Arab Spring, the European summer, and the American fall, not to speak of the Russian winter. And when they're here, as the fifth occupation of planet Earth, when they stand their ground and chant, "We exist," in anger, strength, and wonder, maybe then we can really tackle climate change and hope it isn't too late. Maybe the fifth occupation is the one we're waiting for, and don't for a second doubt that it will come. It is already on its way. And that was The Four Occupations of Planet Earth by Tom Englehart. And he is co-founder of the American Empire Project and the author of The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's, as well as The End of Victory Culture. And he runs the Nation Institute's TomDispatch.com. His latest book, The United States of Fear, Haymarket Books, has just been published. And I'd like to read something without the 10 ways the Occupy movement changes everything. And I'm just going to read the 10. Next week I'll read a little bit more about them. 1, it names the source of the crises. 2, it provides a clear vision of the world we want. 3, it sets a new standard for public debate. 4, it presents a new narrative. 5, it creates a big tent. 6, it offers everyone a chance to create change. 7, it is a movement, not a list of demands. 8, it combines the local and the global. 9, it offers an ethic and practice of deep democracy and community. 10, we have reclaimed our power. And next week, if of course the sky doesn't fall, or I get run over by a log truck, or I fall into the river and stroke for the bar, I'll read what those 10 ways mean. And this is by Sarah Van Gelder, David Corton, and Stephen Piersante. And this has been Michael McCusker. This year, an albacore boat, the Meteor I was aboard in late August, did itself plunge into the Columbia River Bar, capsizing, but all of us survived, which makes us a group of panty waists, I guess. And my mother would be 100 this coming October, although she died at age 95. So, and she was born 2 weeks before Woodrow Wilson was elected to his first term as President of the United States in 1912. So, if everything seems to be okay and I am still here next Thursday, I will read you in depth the 10 ways in which Occupy has changed everything.